Listen, welcome back to this week's series of our Future of Healthcare podcast. We've got Richard and I, as always. Richard's got a beautiful pink shirt on today. Mm. It's pretty hot in the capital, and we've got a really special guest with us in the studio today. So we've got someone who doesn't have a temper, but shares the same surname with a famous tennis player. So we've got Harvey and McIlroy in the studio. Harvey.
Hi, how are you doing?
good. Before we kick in, so Harvey has done, and his team have done a really, really, really transformational work on patient flow. And for those of you who have listened to the series so far and know us, we are passionate. We are, you know, energized about how we can influence, support, and get great thought leadership on patient flow. Before you know, going into the detail around what the Harvey and his team has done so far, I thought it'd be great to get a bit more about you, your journey. What made you join the health service? How did it happen? Give us all of it. So tell us about you.
Sure. Okay. So so I'm Chief Operating Officer at Medway Foundation Trust. I've been with the trust for 9 months. My career in the NHS started about 10 years ago. I was a Band 3 filing clerk, filing notes for a obstetrician and gynaecologist who, funnily enough, worked at Medway as the director of strategy when I started there. So first job in the NHS, filing clerks, booking appointments, working in a gynae clinic. I've sort of got the bug from there, really. And really, I really enjoyed the kind of operational side of the business, though I was a Band 3 and probably had ideas way above my station when it came to redesigning things. Worked at Guy's and St Thomas's for a while, took a lot of training from there. They've got a really great development program there for junior managers. Moved to St George's, where I did a few years as a service manager, became a general manager. I've worked across specialty management in medicine, surgery, outpatients. And it was there that I first got into ED, the emergency department, where I was asked by the chief exec, a really great guy, Miles Scott. He said, would you go in and have a look at the ED and see if there's anything we can do about process that we've applied to outpatients, for example, on flow? Which was my first go at it, and I thought, yeah, this would be great. This can't be difficult at all. It would be just like outpatients. It was a winter leading up to one of the most difficult to date winters that they'd had, and I was asked to find some solutions to the 4-hour breach problem. Bear in mind, George's trauma centre, big complicated medical model. I was way underskilled to do that effectively. And I think I was doing like 16-hour days. I hadn't seen my then fiancé, my now wife, thank God. She accepted marrying me. But I got the bug, completely loved it. From there, have been in the acute and emergency pathway, non-elective pathway for a while. Kept my toe in the water for elective and planned care. Moved to Lewisham Greenwich, have worked at King's. I was speaking to a mentor of mine, and she said, if you want to do well, if you want to succeed and you want to make a difference, and I think that's the key bit. Mm. And I bounced these ideas off of colleagues at King's, she said, listen, you're going to have to go somewhere that doesn't work and make it work and put the real elbow grease and the grind in. And this job came up at the same time as that advice came to me. And I was 2 years at King's, loving it, but I felt it was the right thing to do, and I applied and got it as chief officer. So I've not been more operational in a role as an exec than I have been here. I'm probably more operational now than I was when I was a service manager, when I was filing notes. But it's got a real feel to it, Medway. It's just got a great feel of that, and that's where I'm at now. Board member, exec, and just, yeah, really enjoying being there at the moment.
I love it. It is a tapestry of stuff, right, that you've done. Gynae, I mean, we should all probably get a job in the gynae clinic to be inspired, as you've been inspired. What are you guys doing on flu? Let's talk about that.
So, go back 12 months. So, in fact, go back 3 years for Medway. and I'll sort of tell a story that I wasn't part of, but I'm privy to. 3 years ago, Medway, one of the worst performing trusts in the country from a four-hour perspective, one of the worst performing non-elective centres. And I say that in the context of not quality and safety, but performance. Actually, the quality and safety function of the hospital has always been good, but I think we need to be clear, the performance measure was poor. That, coupled with a really challenging financial deficit, probably the biggest in the world. I might be over-exaggerating, but as a proportion of I&E, it was pretty dire. So 3 years ago, a lot of work went into trying to work out how to fix that, and we've taken probably 5 or 6 stabs at this. And it's been difficult. We've tried to redesign flow by... Go on, sorry.
No, I'm listening.
We've tried to redesign flow...
I signaled them, guys.
Sorry, that's my fault. We tried to redesign flow by implementing new and different ways of working from a senior leadership perspective, from a grassroots perspective, but they've not embedded, they've not landed. So about 9 months ago, my colleague and I, Jack Tabner, our Director of Transformation, got together and spoke about how we could change the basics of flow management at a grassroots basic level. So what is it to move a patient through a hospital at Medway? Not what is it nationally, what does the SAFER bundle tell us, not what does GERFT say, which are all important things, but how does it work for Medway? And taking the experiences that some of our senior team had in different institutions, how can we apply that skill to running flow through the hospital? We started with about 5 flow owners.
Yeah.
And we came up with the principles of flowology, the kind of science of flow at Medway. And we took this out to about 50 people. We put the bid to them and said, look, we want to take flow as a basic principle of time it takes you to get into a bed from a decision to admit as a patient. Universally, the time when you're on a ward before you see a doctor who's going to make a decision about your care. Once you're fit to leave, medically optimised, how long it takes us to decide for you to go home. And at a very basic level, when you leave us, do you leave us at the baseline of fitness level that is safe for you to return to your environment of care or your home? The patient-centric flow principles. So we took those kind of as a context and pitched that to 50 people. 50 people said, yep, we like that. 48 of those 50 were clinicians. One of them was the chief executive, a guy called James Devine, who's been completely behind this all the way. Another was our chairman. And both of them said, yeah, look, this is the program we're going to get behind. This is the flagship. Let's make it the thing we do this year. Mm. Nothing else. Let's make it that. Because we'd done money, we try SIP, we delivered on it. But let's make flow the thing we do this year. So we all got together tail end of last financial year and said, what do we need to do it? We need to bring some experts in. We've done that. We need to get our people bolt into it. How do we turn 50 into 500? And in the last 5 weeks, it really has been 500 people who have genuinely turned up every day to work, who say that patient's going to breach in an hour and 20 minutes because they need to go to gynae or because they need a respiratory bed. They make it happen.
I love it. And we'll come back to this in a second. Rich, you've got a smile in your face. What have you got?
Yeah. So I love your enthusiasm. I think it's commendable. I actually know. You know, we're living in a world where we've got to have a bit more can-do attitude, and it oozes. And I think that's a really good thing. So it's great to have you here. That said, I'm going to put a bit of a black hat on. So I actually started out life in the NHS as a hospital gardener.
Oh, right.
And then I also became chief operating officer and did a few winters. I still enjoy gardening. I love sitting in a room with an enthusiastic chief operator. So I had some wins and some tricky times and some times to celebrate. I was fortunate enough last year to speak at a conference in China about value-based medicine and some stuff that I'd done with a team at the North of Norwich around creating older people's ED and the difference that made in terms of being able to free up capacity and some wins and some enthusiasm. The thing that I didn't expect, so the second affiliated hospital in China, 4,000 beds, just this kind of behemoth of a place.
Yes.
And at the end of my session, one of the hospital administrators came to see me and she said, it's fascinating. She said, we have exactly the same problem in our hospital. She said, I'm often on call and I come in on a Monday morning and we're just overwhelmed with old people. So I recognise that you've done some good stuff, you've got some good wins, and I think that carries that to a point is self-sustaining. But what do you think will break it? What do you think will be the tipping point?
Now, We're excited. What have you got, Abby?
What do you think will Yeah, so we're verging into population health management and socioeconomics and the broader sense of how people use hospitals. I suppose, I mean, if we look further afield, things like the Birdsong model and the model they've tried to apply where you have community-level care for older people in spaces where they are managed out of institutions, as to avoid over-institutionalisation or medical management of people who are frail but not sick. The approach that we're always very prone to take when a patient comes into an acute setting is to medicalise their care, often because they need some baseline readjustment and they need to get back to what we deem to be their fitness level.
Mm.
I think there's lots to say about how we can do that pre-crisis, and pre-crisis management front-loading a lot of the work that we do in a very acute, very expensive setting. You know, £880 a day to be in a hospital bed based on the resource at level one. If you start to go into crit care, you're talking £3,000 a day, right? Where can we do some of that management about that cohort particularly if they're non-acute? And there is a group of people who use institutions who are non-acute because it's the only product available.
Yeah.
And I think if we rethink the offer, and I mean that at a community population base, if we rethink the offer, particularly in deprived, socioeconomically challenged environments, there's a lot we could do to avoid patients coming to big tertiary, secondary care hospitals and actually manage them in a space which is pharmaceutically led, which can be therapeutically led, patient user groups often feedback in lots of roles I've had. All I want is a phone number I can call and just check that the chest pain isn't, in fact, a massive coronary, but instead might just be something to do with the pacemaker I had fitted 9 years ago.
Mm.
If that kind of function exists at a community level, we can avoid secondary and tertiary care.
So
I don't know if that answers the question.
So it answers my question, but it does more than that. So it takes me straight into my next question.
We didn't prep that, did we?
No, we didn't prep that at all, which is extraordinary for others that have listened to these podcasts. Where do you think digital transformation perhaps then fits in to enable some of that kind of stuff that you talked about?
It's the key enabler, actually. So I think the cohort we're referring to in the previous conversation about the frail elderly, it's a slightly more complicated but still facilitated group. But if we take, for example, the group who are working age, attendance frail or comorbid, people who have long-term conditions, rheumatological, diabetological even, hard word to say at this time on a Thursday, that patient cohort can be managed in a telederm or tele room or tele gastro environment at a GP or at a primary care setting, or from the home environment with the right tracking and technology. I say this like it's easy. It's absolutely not easy. That stuff takes a lot to now get into the right healthcare environment and the right healthcare economy. I think if we think of the NHS as the structure, in the one I'm used to, we're much less likely to adopt it than some international structures who are much more willing.
And this is a comment more than a question. But if you'll indulge me for a moment, what I think is exciting about what you've done is often flow problems can be so corrosive. They're terrible for patients, but they're terrible for hospital teams as well. That you have no time to think about anything else. The kind of stuff that you're talking about is for another day because you're stuck in trying to solve day to day things. So I think for me, what I'm hearing from you is something really exciting. But you've got yourself some breathing space to be able to hopefully do some of that good stuff. So I wish you well on that. There's more questions for you later. But I think that's where I'll hand back to Orlando.
So I love it. Who's doing it really well? Outside of the NHS that you've looked at, what model works? Is it the Middle East? And we always ask this question, right? Is it the Middle East? Is it the US? Is it Iceland? Who's got a model that you think, actually, these guys have really got their flow stuff as a well-lubricated, well-oiled machine working?
So I'm not an expert in the external factors of flow in some of those institutions. Mm. I suppose we are often pointed toward Virginia Mason and the lean methodology processes that we apply and that those institutions have applied over in the States as standout examples of how to take waste out of systems and in turn how to get the best and quickest outcome for the user, the patient in this case. I think we're prone to those. I think if you look at some of the Norse, Icelandic, Swedish Denmark models that they're applying around community-based and outreach care, taking specialists from hospitals and moving them into community settings. The boundaries of the hospital then becomes a self-referral process by a specialist instead of a general practice pathway. Now, that's not new. Spain has been doing that for years, and that works. But what they're doing, though, is taking the expertise to more junior-graded non-medical specialists. And I think that's quite fun, and that's quite different. And if we think about how that changes the face of medicine, actually, you don't have to have a £400,000-a-year practitioner delivering on a really hyper-specialist model that only three people in the world do. If you can train 25 therapists who could do part of that work to avoid the crisis, which makes better the quality of life for the service user, it makes better the time that they spend with not needing tertiary and secondary care intervention, which is often, when it gets to that level, surgical, bed-based care, or medical intervention, which needs...
Is that what
complex.
You think the future is? Javi, do you know, when you think about the next decade in healthcare, right, what does that look like, irrespective of the UK or where? Mm. You know, what is a great interaction with... Because most people... this is factual. Most people who have not been as privileged as you, Richard, you know, etc., to know the inner workings of a health system, still don't know how to interact with it, right? Mm. So they've got this kind of really bizarre relationship with be it the NHS or whatever their health provider ecosystem is. What do you think the next decade looks like in terms of solving that problem? And you know, in your mind, what is the Magna Carta of healthcare look like at that point?
Gosh, that's a very big question. Anything with the word Magna Carta in it is worrying. Okay, so 10 years, I think that there's a natural bias in my description because of the environment I'm used to.
There's no wrong answer,
but,
right?
But broadening it, I think care closer to home, and I don't mean in a polyclinic model setting because that's a failed principle. I mean in the self-management and care closer to home by non-complex medical professional is one of the ways in which we will manage that. I think there is an ever-growing school of thought amongst patient advocate groups, which is give patients more information about how to avoid becoming unwell critically or at a crisis level. I think prehabilitation is a key part to that. And if I explain what I mean by that, and this is some really exciting work that's being done. Middle East are doing this work. The US and Australia are doing this work. How do you prepare older and more frail patients who don't have to just be old, but let's remember we have an aging population and that is going to be a strain on us for 10 years, as it is in lots of health economies, to be fit to receive medical management, to receive surgical management. Yeah. Now, we do lots of rehab, and that's a post intervention into a patient's likelihood to recover. Mm. How do we do prehab? And that's getting them fit to be intervened in.
Mm-hmm.
And that sounds very scientific, but if you're going in for a big, complex surgical... Well, if you're having your hip done, doesn't it? If you're having your hip done and you're 84 and you're otherwise mobile, but the joint, the bone is now malfunctioning and you're bone on bone and you've lost your cartilage. Now, you're completely compos mentis, your blood pressure's great, you don't have any comorbid mental health conditions at this stage. Going into a hospital can set all of that off.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now, if we can prehabilitate you to be fit to be discharged in 3 days instead of 14 without needing complex therapeutic management and pain management upon leaving, you won't become institutionalized. I think that's a big part of the next 10 years. We have to prehab patients.
I love it. I love it. And I love it. I love it.
I think he likes that.
On the work that you guys have, the great work that you guys have been doing with Flow, for our listeners who are other chief operating officers or the chief execs, etc., and maybe these are not the categories that are appropriate, right? But in my mind, I assume workforce, I assume money, I assume infrastructure, like hospital, physical building.
Mm.
As some of the kind of, you know, it must be in one of these buckets, or clinical, that you might have struggled. Where have you struggled most in terms of getting Flow to work? What has been the biggest sort of bottleneck to Flow?
Okay, so our Flow program has consciously tried to steer away from the binary problem.
Ooh.
If I explain what I mean by that, let's not be restricted by the space we have. Let's think differently about how we can change it. So there's a 33-bedded frailty ward. that might not be what we need. Yeah. Let's go back and work out what our point of prevalence audit shows us on where patients who are older with frail needs should be admitted. Mm. So today we had a great discussion with two of our acute physicians who I'm not sure agreed with each other either way, but they came up with very coherent arguments about two different acute medical models. Now, we've done the data for them. We've done something called a one version of the truth diagnostic. You know, this phrase has been flying around for a while. ROVT, we call it. And we walk around with these sort of dog-eared copies of the OVT in my back pocket or Jack's back pocket, and we say, listen, what does the OVT tell us about frail admissions? Not what am I telling you about your decision as a frailty practitioner or as a cardiologist or as a respiratory doctor? What does my OVT data say about your demand? From that, we can then say, well, the state's constraint is that I don't have enough beds based on my admission profile. Mm. Are we converting right? And then we say, right, well, if we're converting right, we need more beds. Because we're converting right, we're seeing the right people. Our length of stay isn't out on the model hospital data set. We know that our peers are roughly where we are. It means we've got a different group of people. Yeah. So don't be constrained by the physical constraint. Yeah. And as a result, we're building a new gastro ward this year. Because we know last year, and we know our data shows that that was our problem. Okay. So I think the binary stuff, we've tried to free our clinicians from being locked into. And that's not clean sheet redesign. That's dangerous when you give anybody a blank sheet and say, go away and design it. It'll come back with a £1 billion hospital. And that might be what we need here. We're not there today. So the biggest blockers haven't been that kind of thing. I think the biggest blockers have been belief in what we can achieve. We've done this 5 times, and I can't think of a hospital that hasn't. And when I talk to Coup peers, and when I talk to chief execs, you know, one day hopefully in that chair, and I say, what's difficult? It's that I've made them do this 5 times, and they don't want to do it again. They don't believe in doing it again. Not because they don't want to make it work, but because they don't think it will. And when you sit with some chief execs and some chairmen and some Qs who are really inspiring, and you go, yeah, no, I get behind that and I want to do it with you, but I've been burned. And we've got a great group of doctors down at Midway who are not an ivory tower, won't talk about getting change done because, you know, I'm just going to do my job and wait for you to go. Some of them wait for me to go and they'll see me out, I'm sure. But 98% of the people we dealt with, these 500 who we started with a cast of 5, we called it the choir, and how big can you grow the choir so we're all singing the same song, they're mostly doctors who now say, yeah, but we believe you can do it now. And they turn up to weekly task groups, they turn up to daily huddles, and it's not faces of managers, it's therapists, pharmacists, consultants, GPs are getting involved.
What made them do it on the 5th time? And then not the 4th or the 2nd.
So some of that was about how we pitched this version of it.
They start believing and they didn't believe in number 2?
Maybe. Like the flow, maybe. Well, I think one...
Is it your charisma?
I don't think it's that, no. You can't make people do that on that basis. 1 to 5, if we go back over the Medway journey, but Medway's not unique, I've done this in a few places. If we go back over the 1 to 5, though, it's that it was started in winter in response to crisis. A bit like the patient, right? If we did some prehab on this, it wouldn't have been in crisis. We did it saying that this won't land tomorrow. We don't expect 95% tomorrow. We don't expect occupancy to come down by 10% next week. But what we'll do in preparing is get you to baseline where you think you can be month on month for 12 months. And we said this is a 12-month project. But what was different is the chief executive, the director of strategy, the director of transformation, the chief operating officer came out and said, in one voice, this is the last time we're going to do it. We genuinely mean it's the last time we're going to do it because we're going to get it right. And the medical director backed us and said, yep, we're going to take one more go. And not only is this a good program, this is the program.
Richard, you've been doing this for quite a long time, friend.
For the listeners, I am the oldest person.
I doubt it.
You're being unfair.
what do you recognise... as a sort of the usual suspect in terms of, you know, not getting it right.
Not getting it right.
Yeah, but what if he was struggling with it, right?
Yeah, so exactly as Harvey said, not getting it right is often doing it because somebody told you to, or trying to do it because somebody told you to, and not building a consensus in a small group of people that can then grow and gaining confidence through success and planning it that way and being realistic and all those things. Not doing that, doing the opposite of that, you know, coming out in what I'd describe as being a typically sausage-fingered, you know, NHS manager, and you know, just switches people off. So that's a start point. There is something though about, and I think your point about one version of the truth is right, because sometimes you also have to, I think in Harvey's position, you also have to be prepared to be brave and say, we've worked all this stuff out, and actually, even if we do all the things that we know will work, we've got an engaged team, it might not be possible in the operating model that we have, but you can only have that conversation if you've worked it through and you've got everybody behind you, and there aren't the holes where they say, well, actually, if you just got people behind you, you'd have been successful.
Yeah.
You maybe wouldn't have been, but you've got to do that. Just in a slightly negative scenario, you've still got to have done that to be able to prove that something very different systemically is required.
Mm.
So
I love it. You had an interesting question.
Well, I did, and I'm mindful of time, but we, you know, hopefully I won't get edited out, and the listeners will never know if I have been. So we've had effectively a change of government, got a new Prime Minister. I'm going to edit down my question. But for the, in this instance, Harvey, you are the new Secretary of State for Health, okay?
Right.
So what one thing will be at the top of your list if you were going into your first cabinet meeting and you're it?
Gosh, that's a big question. So can I have two things?
Yeah.
Can I have two things?
You can have two things.
One of them would be digitization, the digitization agenda for health, and how we bring forward what lots of good functioning healthcare economies internationally have done, which we've not done. And I think that's got to be at the forefront of the next 3 years, probably. That's about as long as a health secretary normally lasts, give or take. And I think the next thing would be... This is a slightly more nebulous one, but I think it's something about understanding... back to population healthcare principles. Understanding our data, understanding the information that drives health. We spend a lot of time in our day job describing variation or impact that is probably highly predictable, that often a lot of the time was not due to any change in seasonality surge or patient behaviour. And we lose ourselves hours, days, weeks, years in describing it to regulatory models who I think try and support us, but are in between the devil and the deep blue sea with regulation and government, who have to describe a reason why something happened.
Yeah.
And we end up black swanning it a lot. You know, that principle of you describe a variable that you didn't understand the impact of and you pretend it was that.
Yeah.
And I'm not opening Pandora's box on this one and letting them know the secret, but you say, you know, we fell over yesterday because, or last year was like this because, it probably wasn't. And understanding more about the reason and how people use health, and in turn how in therefore we commission health, would be one of my big things as if I were health secretary.
So I like both of those. You can have
brilliant.
You can have
I'll take both of them.
With a bit of luck, the current health secretary is listening to this podcast. And if you get a job as an advisor,
that'll do.
Your friends up.
Okay.
But listen, that brings us unfortunately to the end of today. But I think for the listeners, I'd add this: we've had a lot of very great people on this series so far, and I'm sure we'll continue to have great people on it. But Harvey is slightly unusual. You can't see him in this room, right, because it's obviously audio. But he's got a good infectious level of energy, which I'm sure you guys, hopefully you heard through the podcast, but if not, there you go. I've described it to you.
I will.
We're done.
Great.
Thank you.